Okay, we're recording.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we talk about politics, social issues, and current events. We've been doing this for 6 months now, and I think that's probably the first time that I've actually mentioned name all three of those things without stumbling over my words.
I'm impressed.
Thank you very much, Jimmy. My name is Jazza, and on Twitter I am at JazzaJohn. Jimmy is also here.
I am here.
What are you?
I'm at Jodie Nichols.
And we have a guest this week called Lena.
Oh, hey.
Oh, hey.
Oh, hey.
What are you on the internet?
I am at Lena Norms.
Mm-hmm.
Double E.
Yeah, and you're also on YouTube. What do you do on...
Well, that's the word.
What do you do on YouTube? What's, like, your shtick? Because this is a thing that we never do. We never get them to introduce themselves. So introduce yourself a little bit to the people.
Okay, so I do a YouTube channel called Just Kiss My Frog. And I talk about books and some feminism when I feel the need, which isn't always, but sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just can't not. And just generally thought. Sometimes I play the ukulele in my bath because I'm a manic pixie dream girl.
Manic pixie nightmare girl.
Yeah, exactly. That's me. That's what I do. And I work in the book industry, which might come in useful later.
It will be coming in useful later. Because every week we talk about three topics that have happened in the past week in the news. And this week we're going to be talking about Angela Merkel, who now Lena knows who she is.
I've just read about, you know, three paragraphs of a Time article, so I'm well up for this.
Yeah, so Angela
Merkel... As well briefed as you need to be.
I'll be Merkling along.
We're very unbriefed here, Right Dishonourable. But basically, Angela Merkel has been made Person of the Year by Time Magazine.
According to
Time Magazine. Although it is the definitive Person of the Year award, I feel,
it
right?
It is, actually, yeah.
Yeah, sadly.
Mate,
oh my god, can we do an... This is
the
just like content for the website.
Dishonourable. The 100 most dishonourable
people. I mean, some of the people that wrote the time list would definitely qualify.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely.
We definitely use the baseline.
But we are going to be talking about whether this is a justified award that she's been given and basically how she's doing as the de facto leader of the European Union. So that's going to be a bit of a fun chat. After that, we're also going to be talking about somebody else who is on the Time Person of the Year list, and that is Mr. Donald J. Trump.
As he refers to himself.
As he refers to himself, like, all of the time. Like, he refers to himself in the third person,
so
like,
you know
loads.
What that J stands for? That's what I'm suspicious of.
If I had prepared, I would have come up with something very funny to say right now. But no, I think it's like John.
Jiggling Trump.
And basically, if you've missed this, then you're living under a rock. But he this week came out and said that he wants to stop all Muslims from coming into the USA.
That's both tourists and immigrants.
That's well. Absolutely
it's a full blind ban.
Everybody
what
and
the
yeah I know right. And we're going to talk about the implications of that in a global context. It's going to be really intellectual. And then finally, we're going to be talking about books for a little bit because Lena's here. What are we going to be talking about,
well,
Lena?
Well, BBC Culture just came out with their top 100 books, but as judged by people outside of the UK, so top 100 British books as seen by the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk about that, and I'd like to also kind of go into women's awards and why we think that, because actually a massive percentage of these books are written by women. So people have been commenting on that in loads of different plethoras of ways. So I want to talk a bit more.
Plethoras of ways. Plethoras excellent.
Of ways.
Let's put some music on and then we'll dive into our first topic. That'd be nice, won't it?
Yeah.
Good.
A dive.
Angela Merkel is the Chancellor who's celebrating her 10th year as the leader of Germany at the moment.
Indeed.
So that's
that's a thing.
A thing.
Yeah.
It's very good. And she's now, after her 10th year, been made the Person of the Year by Time Magazine. Arguably, weirdly, it's weird timing, seeing as she's been a very prominent person in at least European politics for a really long time, right?
Yeah, but Time, like... sort of loves her because of her approach to the refugee crisis and lots of other things.
Yeah.
So
And what's really interesting is that, well, interesting, but also kind of shameful, Lena. You weren't quite sure who she was until we said
I didn't know, and to be honest, even at this point, I'm not sure. So, you know, when you were like, you don't know who, if you don't know who Donald Trump is, you're living under a rock, and I'm like, be aware there are a lot of rocks, so, and you can find yourself under one very easily.
So what do you know of, like, the Time Person of the Year Award, and why do you think that it's, from what you've read, why do you think that it's possibly important that Angela has won this?
Well, I think it's interesting when you were like, oh, it's only now that we're making her Time Person of the Year. But actually, I think in Germany, people are a lot more sensitive to bad leaders, and they're very, like, fast to kick them off. So the fact that she's been here 10 years is almost, like, now's the time to really recognise it. Do you not think?
What makes you say that Germany is particularly sensitive to bad leaders?
I get the feeling that they're a lot more, I don't know... With Britain, I think we have a slight bit more patience or apathy towards leaders that we don't like. We will vote them back in if we think they're going to be okay later. But I think Germany's a little bit more sensitive.
I don't know. I feel like that's part of Angela's appeal.
That's a massive generalisation.
Yeah, I feel like Angela...
If you said that about Australia, then that would have been...
Australia have gone through, like, 10 leaders in the past 3 years. Mm. That's an exaggeration, but it's pretty high. But Angela, I think that the way that she... Because we're on first-name terms, apparently. Angela, she... Like, part of her appeal, especially in Germany, is quite how slow and plodding she is, and quite how inoffensive she is, and her ability to kind of be like a broker in deals. And I think that's what has kind of, that's what's made her the major politician, like probably the most significant post reunification politician in Germany. And I think that's pretty there's not a lot of controversy in making that statement.
Maybe Helmut Kohl, I guess. He was the first, Chancellor post unification.
But
there's only been like three or four. It's not.
Yeah, yeah. There haven't been a huge number. Yeah. But also, she's been quite special in that she is the chancellor in a grand coalition, which basically means that the two largest parties now are governing together. The head of the Socialist Party in Germany is now the finance minister in her administration. Mm. And so what this has kind of created in Germany is a lack of an opposition, but the Germans seem to still be very happy with that kind of a setup.
But as you alluded to earlier, there's a lot of unhappiness about the way she's actually invited lots of refugees from the Middle East into the country, and there's a lot of... But the backbiting seems to come from the press rather than from the opposition, because there is a lack of one, as you say.
Yeah, so do you feel like the main reason that she has been given this award... does she get, like, a plaque or something? That would be quite nice for her.
I assume there must be a plaque,
or, like,
right?
One of those dishes that they get in, like, the Women's Wimbledon Award that has, like, engraving on it. That would be quite nice to put up in her house.
Yeah, that sounds a bit shit for, like, Person of the Year.
Yeah. You know?
Like, what do you get? You should just get another person. Yeah. Like, Person of the Year, have another person.
Yeah. But it feels like... I feel like the major thing that Merkel has done in the past year is open up Germany to the large numbers of Syrian refugees and of refugees in general who have been displaced by ISIS.
So that's one of the reasons time have given it to her. The other thing is how she handled the Greek debt crisis as well. And there was also, they make in the essay they've written about, so they make allusions to the way she handled Ukraine as well. Mm-hmm. But obviously that's a bit more mixed, really.
So I feel, because she has been like a really significant leader in the European Union, specifically because of the Greek crisis, where she has kind of been a lot more controversial in the way that she's managed things, because she was like, Greece have to stay in the euro against all costs, otherwise they leave and they default to the drachma. And then the way that she... Like, it was seen that she was the person leading that kind of charge to keep Greece in the euro. And it feels like... like, especially when you hear from, like, the Greek point of view, that it's the Germans who are kind of deciding the fate of Greece, which, I mean, when you have, like, a large conglomerate like the European Union, that's inevitably going to happen, but also people who haven't been elected by the Greek people have ended up deciding Greek's fate, and that... I feel like that is marks against her more than anything, but time seemed to hold that up as a reason why she's a great leader.
But it's one of those things that when foreigners look at a country's leader, they judge them on completely different standards from the way...
Obama is like a really big example of that, right?
Yeah. So in America, you can very easily just find people who really hate Obama.
Mm-hmm.
But in the UK, the impression of Obama is hugely positive, overwhelmingly so. And I feel the way that Time is in American politics is a hugely liberal magazine.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of our equivalent of The Guardian, basically, or The New Statesman. So the way they look at Merkel, for all sorts of reasons, is this bastion of liberal goodness, basically.
Do you think that they're correct in that? Do you think that we, perhaps, in Europe, have a more kind of pragmatic and perhaps jaded view of Angela Merkel?
Well, they're also really nice about the EU, and I think even people who really like the EU...
Although they do call it incredibly dull, but efficient in its dullness.
I mean, it's not really efficient. That's
something
that no one who knows about the EU would say, so it does kind of reveal a bit of ignorance on Time's part, but...
Yeah, it was...
It is boring.
It is an odd article, because it seems to take a lot of the things that we see as, criticisms of the European Union as, positives. And so, for example, things like the ability to move between borders without passports, they go into a lot of detail describing a road between Austria and Germany.
Yeah.
And it's like you have to ask the local people whether you're in Austria or Germany, because there's no way of actually telling, because the asphalt is the same, all of the road signs are in the same language. Whereas we're currently, especially in the UK, having a really grand debate about the bad points of having open borders.
Mm.
And the fact that David Cameron is going around and negotiating to try and potentially change that, although it doesn't look like that's actually going to happen.
We probably should compare Merkel to the other sort of runners up in this contest.
Yeah.
So hang on, I need to grab
the thing.
We have a prop actual Times magazine. Who says the dead tree press is really dead?
So the second one is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who is described here as ISIS's leader. He's number two, I assume, because this is the Time Person of the Year is all about influence, as opposed to saying who's the nicest guy.
So Hitler has won it before,
right? Yeah. Donald Trump is third. Black Lives Matter, which the overall movement is fourth. Hassan Rouhani, who's the Iranian president, is fifth, and Uber's chief executive Travis Kalanick is sixth, and then Caitlyn Jenner is seventh.
Yeah.
So,
what do you think that really they should have put al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, as the most influential person of the year? Because he's certainly the person who has steered at least... steered international politics more than anybody
else.
I'm
not sure ISIS are a particularly monolithic organisation in terms of,
There's cells everywhere, right?
Yeah, it's very, spread out, and there's a lot of different things going on, whereas Merkel is at least fully in control of her country, basically, so... You look like you want to say something.
I think it's really interesting to talk about, what's most influential, because I feel like these are all the topics that have been most in the news, but then the news control that, don't they? Do you know what I mean? It's kind of how many people have you influenced? I'd say, yeah, I think he should be second, because he has influenced the most amount of, I don't know, I think people's attitude towards their own culture and other people's cultures.
I feel like
the Uber drive, he's influenced business. It's really hard to, do you know what I mean? To give somebody an award that's you're the person of the year, and it's in what do you know what I mean?
Well, there's definitely an argument for having, a Xi Jinping somewhere on this list, just because he's the leader of the world's largest country. Is there anyone that you'd actually pick out who's not on this list?
I'd have to go away and think about that. I can't say. I genuinely wouldn't be able to say.
Is there anybody there who you don't think should be on it?
The Uber driver guy.
Why do you say that?
Because I think it's a good idea, but it's not an original idea. And it's while he's executed it quite widely.
I think the reason he's on this list is not really to do with Uber in and of itself. The point about the reason Uber matters is it's reshaping the way the jobs market works, basically. Mm. And Uber's been involved in litigation across the entire world, sort of over arguments about what responsibilities they have to their employees.
Yeah.
And it's obviously also it's a prime example of how tech is now undercutting existing markets.
Mm-hmm.
So
I feel like that is more of a representative of the changing. He's been chosen as a
as somebody who started a conversation about it, rather. That's why I think I'm like.
But like also people like Airbnb, who are also criticised for a load of reasons because people end up turning residential flats into basically hotels.
Yeah.
And that is like a really significant part of the changing economy. Mark Zuckerberg, who was the most influential person in 2010,
yeah.
Is also somebody who has changed like the way that advertising has worked. And those, and I feel like this Uber guy, what's his name?
Travis Kalanick.
He's kind of like the representative of the changing economy, rather than Uber is changing the world.
So do you think that he influenced people, or the way that he started doing business has started a conversation that has influenced people? Because I feel like the way he does business challenges whether we regulate and how we license businesses.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if he directly was intentionally... Do people get on this list if they intentionally influence people, or is it by accident? I don't think he intentionally... Do you know what I mean?
He's infamous for being a massive dick and just like trashing litigators and saying, yeah, we don't give a fuck, we're just going to push into this market and we don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So he's actually... in of himself, he's actually quite a good example of the bullishness of the tech industry.
Somewhat ironically, perhaps, Uber is banned in Germany, I believe. And I think it's still banned in Germany because of the competition laws that exist there.
Well, I think it's banned in Austria, potentially, like certain states in Australia.
And the EU is like pulling its hair out on how to deal with this like huge revolution in like the way that industry exists. Speaking about people who you think should be in it who aren't in like this top tier, who do you think may have been skimmed over, Jimmy?
Oh god.
See, it's a hard question, isn't it? You're like, Lena, just pick anybody.
I've already said Xi Jinping. I can't imagine that they didn't discuss including him in some capacity. They must have discussed Pope Francis as well, who won it in 2013.
Yeah.
I think. I think it's quite a good list.
In terms, it is pretty good and like a lot more internationalist than I think it has been in the past. Because I think that Time does very often have a habit of being like the US is the only country and they are the most important.
I'd say the opposite is true in a way.
Do you think so?
Time have a very internationalist outlook on politics, which sort of fits in with their liberalism and their feelings towards the Europe as well.
Yeah. Somebody who if we were doing kind of like a more Europe focused one, I did like the Front National really needs to be in there. I think especially although this is after the past week that they've really come to prominence with Marine Le Pen as leader of the party. And they are the party that's getting the most votes in the French regional elections that we talked about last week.
They've chosen Trump, and in a lot of ways you could say Marine Le Pen is a better choice because Trump, there's a very low chance he'll actually become US president, because even if he gets the Republican ticket, Hillary Clinton is very likely to beat him.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Marine Le Pen is a plausible French president.
Yeah.
That's not something that is completely out of the question. So she's far more likely to actually change the way politics works across the whole of the EU than Donald Trump is in the US.
But she hasn't yet, so maybe next year.
Oh, so
it's more like who's going to influence.
We'd have to wait until 2017 until like the French presidential election actually happens. But I think that that's somebody to look out for.
Wonder what?
I'm waiting for vloggers as like a. Like, obviously, I have to adjust it to this. But, like, independent media creators. People like even The Young Turks and people like SourceFed, Vlog Brothers, who genuinely do like...
Do you have a disclosure to make about Vlog Brothers?
I have no agenda. Okay. Believe it or not.
But the amount of, like, power that somebody like Zoella has in terms of their audience and, like, PewDiePie...
Power's a bit generous.
No,
again, do you think it could be more of, like, would YouTube ever get on there? Because, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg's in there. It's more like creating a platform for those people to exist.
There's no figurehead of YouTube because the people who set up YouTube have now moved on to other things. Mm-hmm. It's kind of been absorbed into Google, so...
Yeah, that would be more difficult. Which is why I think, like, the independent content creator would be an interesting one to kind of, like, keep your eye on. However, the way that YouTube kind of operates, it does make it less easy to be somebody who is, like, genuinely goes in there and shakes shit up. and more kind of, this is like us as creators, we definitely have these kinds of discussions a lot. Don't we?
Do you think there should be like a person of the year for YouTube? Because then we could, like, Sam Pepper would be up there because he's shaking stuff up. He could have Donald Trump slot.
We actually discussed Sam Pepper last week.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
So maybe I need to be taking this article as an idea to 1080. I feel like we've discussed this topic quite well. Good.
Yeah,
I feel fulfilled.
8 out of 10. I feel educated. 8 out of 10. I know a little bit more. Than I did before. Isn't that the
Isn't it just though?
This rock is feeling so light.
Speaking of Time Person of the Year, number 3 was Donald Trump.
Yeah.
See, I did manage to get a second.
It would have been better if you'd done it before the end of the last segment.
Nobody needs to know. No one needs to know. Donald Trump has ended up being, yet again, a grand controversialist and has suggested banning all Muslim people from entering the US. So this isn't something that's actually going to happen in terms of, like, US policy yet, because he isn't yet president. And also, he's probably not going to become president, so it's not... we don't have to worry about this happening anytime soon. However, something that has been quite interesting in a lot of the commentary that has happened after this is the fact that the US now has, like, a point in history where they have a mainstream candidate for president who wants to enact these kinds of really extreme policies against a specific religious group. And... a lot of people on the Republican side of the aisle will claim that there has been condemnation of the words that he's said, though it's been pretty bloody light compared to, like...
It's been quite forthcoming internationally, though. Like, David Cameron said, he didn't quite say he's an idiot, but that's sort of the imprint. A lot of international politicians came out and said... No.
But I feel like it's one of those topics that's so widely covered because everybody agrees, and on some level it makes it a discussion point, but it's also quite encouraging because I'm just like, well, adults don't do that. I'm just like, well, this is clearly a child and an adult, but, like, do you know what I mean? I'm just like, this is clearly wrong.
These are, like, views that you will hear down the pub, like, every Saturday, depending on which pub one frequents, or, like, you'll hear it with, like, elderly relatives or whatever, and you don't really expect to hear it in mainstream politics. And whether we like it or not, Donald Trump is a mainstream candidate for president. He has, throughout the since he announced his candidacy at the beginning of summer, he has been at the top of the pile, and he's currently above 30% in the Republican primary polls. I think he's at about 35, and then his next candidate, and then the next candidate after him is Ted Cruz, who isn't much fluffier, to be completely honest. And there's a group of, like, 3 or 4 who are second, who are chasing for second.
At least Ben Carson's on the way down.
Ben Carson's in the way down, but I liked him because he was quite cute.
But he said, I don't think a Muslim could be president of the USA, and then he rode back on it. So
I think that he was quite, like, that was a weird conversation that was happening.
He's a weird guy.
He is a very odd guy. Although nothing compared to Donald Trump.
Yeah, but Trump is just, like, obnoxious, like, rather than weird, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. What has been super interesting is seeing kind of, like, the international condemnation of it, which, would he to become president, could be kind of problematic.
What I thought was interesting about the British coverage of this is a few articles I saw were headlining with, like, Trump disqualifies himself from becoming president. Mm-hmm. And then you click on it, you're like, actually, he's not disqualified by any... Do you know what I mean? But that's how they got people to click on it, because people want to see legislation, like validating. Do you know what I mean? People want to know, like, the comforting thing about that title is that, like, oh yeah, cool, but there's rules against this. But there's not any rules against this at all. Like, he doesn't disqualify himself.
One could argue that, and I think it's a very strong argument, that the US Constitution, which is what it is, the president's job to uphold the Constitution,
says
that you can, like, you wouldn't be able to pass a law like that because it goes against the Constitution in so many ways.
The First Amendment, mainly.
I think there's also the 14th Amendment, which says that you can't be discriminated against based on your private life, which includes religion, sexuality, and that's how we ended up getting gay marriage in the whole of the USA, because of those rights. And this clearly goes against them. But what I think is super interesting, because the Republican Party is shitting itself right now, like, obviously, because there's no way that somebody like Trump would be able to win. And there's also the threat of him leaving the Republican Party and running as an independent candidate, which would basically hand the presidency to probably Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. And basically, so what I've heard in the US press is that the Republican National Convention, who are the people who select the candidate for president and make it all official, have said that they're going to start considering the what would happen if it were possible that the that there wasn't a clear front runner for the Republican nomination to go up in the head-to-head with Hillary Clinton. But the thing is, there is a clear front runner, and that front runner is Donald Trump. And they're kind of pulling their hair out that they might actually end up being represented by this guy.
So I thought the hope was that Trump's getting about a third of the vote, but the hope is eventually all the other candidates will drop out except one, and all that support will coalesce behind one candidate who won't be Donald Trump but might be Ted Cruz.
So there is... So there is that hope, but it doesn't seem to be happening. Nobody seems willing to drop out of the race, even the people who are on, like, below 1% in those polls.
What's interesting about them kind of, like, crapping themselves about this all falling apart is that he's clearly been saying stuff like that behind closed doors for a long time, and they've let him stay and let him rise. Just because he's saying it in public doesn't mean it's the first time he's said it.
No, it doesn't. But then I think that saying stuff as the front runner for the Republican candidate for president is very different to saying something behind closed doors.
Yeah, and I think of the thing of, like, oh, like, don't worry, he doesn't represent all of us. We'll still be your candidate. Yeah. It's like, well, if you even associate yourself with him, like, why haven't you kicked him out? Like, is that bad?
But then,
like, how has it been this far,
in
guys?
In a two-party system, you always have, like, the moderate in each party. You have a moderate wing and you have the crazies. Like, in the UK, the Labour crazies are currently in charge of the Labour Party.
Yeah.
When Blair was in power, it was the Tory crazies who were in charge of the Tory party. So these things do happen. It doesn't necessarily disqualify the entire Republican Party, although there's plenty of...
Although it does make me judge them that they seem so, you know, that if they're actually in an emergency state and they're shocked and they're crapping themselves, and I'm like, if you didn't see this coming, then I think you're a bit broken anyway.
But this is clearly a tactic by him. Every time that he said something particularly abhorrent, so he said things like he's obsessed with building a wall between the US and Mexico.
So he said all the Mexicans were rapists.
All Mexicans. He implied all Mexicans. Mexicans were...
I mean, at this point, you can't really libel Trump, so I can just say what the fuck I like about him. He called the newscaster woman, said that she was on her period or something.
Megyn Kelly from Fox News. She asked him a particularly difficult question and said, well, there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her, everywhere.
I hadn't heard that one.
That was horrific. Absolutely horrific. But every time that he's said something like that, his poll numbers have jumped. At the expense of everybody else. People have been waiting and been saying that, oh, we just need Donald Trump to say something really, really stupid, and then his poll numbers will collapse. But it hasn't happened. The opposite has happened. They've only... Like, every time that he starts to kind of dip... There was a point a few... Like, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago where Ben Carson was jostling for the front position.
Yeah.
Then Donald Trump started saying horrible things about Muslims, and he went up and Ben Carson went down, and implying that, like, The Ben Carson followers were going over to Trump and deciding that Trump was the best person.
Yeah, he does represent that left-behind constituency, which I referred to before, like people who used to have steady working-class jobs and now, like sort of deindustrialization has thrown them out and they're sort of worried about how the country's changing.
Yeah, there's people saying that this is, like, unprecedented in the US, that somebody so right-wing is a main contender.
Former presidents were part of the Ku Klux Klan. This isn't... If you're saying that, you don't know your history.
Yeah, okay. But also in the EU, we've been dealing with, like, these right-wing... reclaiming the working class, anti-immigration policy, parties like the Front National, like UKIP, like Danish parties.
In Britain, we largely haven't had to deal with it partly because of our first-past-the-post system keeps people like that marginalised, and also the way British, like, it's sort of an anti-fascist thing, like, fascism has never really taken in Britain that well.
Mm-hmm. So. I mean, we did have the black shirts,
yeah,
who were, like, the unashamedly fascist party.
But post-World War II, we haven't really had that, whereas France has had that for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. What I think is something that we probably should talk about is the fact that these are all poll numbers being made before anybody has actually cast a vote.
And so I think that until people actually start casting votes, we need to take all of this with a pinch of salt. And especially at the beginning of the Republican primary process, people were like, oh, it was a list of, like, 17 names, 17, like, serious candidates who were putting themselves up for the nomination. And people were just like, oh, I don't really know any of them apart from Jeb Bush and Donald Trump. I don't really like the Bushes, so Donald Trump had the highest name recognition. Mm. And that was kind of given as the reason. And I wonder how much of that has kind of snowballed because of the amount of media attention that he gets, because a Donald Trump article gets clicks.
He's very good value for money.
But also, but in the UK, we have experienced the kind of falseness and the possible inaccuracy of poll numbers ourselves, right? So I wonder how much of this is the only people who are answering the phone and doing these surveys anymore are people who are... feeling particularly disenfranchised.
Yeah. It's worth pointing out the UK polls weren't horrendously out at the general election. The main thing is that the headline result was so close that they called it on the wrong side. But they actually got the SNP wiping out Labour correct. They got the UKIP's rise correct. Mm-hmm. They got Lib Dems being destroyed correct as well. So they're actually...
Yeah, but
there's quite a lot of accuracy in that.
But there was a lot of, like, extreme, right? In terms of... So we didn't expect the Lib Dems to be wiped out nearly as much. We were expecting...
Some people did, actually.
That wasn't part of, like... I was there, Jimmy. I remember. Jesus.
Front line.
Yeah. I think that it was a huge shock for the majority of people when the Conservatives came back with the majority.
The Tories were in government.
So I think that we do kind of have to take some of this with a pinch of salt. And I'm not sure how much we can actually, like, look into how the polls are done. But until people actually start casting votes in primaries... I don't think that we can really see him as a really serious contender.
I don't think it will change as much as you think, but I think either way the Republican Party's fucked and the Democrats are going to win. I think you can fairly safely say that.
So some polls and some, like, pundits have seen a moderate candidate like Marco Rubio, for example, from Florida, who's a senator from Florida. If he is the Republican nomination, he's one of the only ones who could possibly beat Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, that's fair.
And so the UK government is apparently preparing for a Marco Rubio ticket to go up against Hillary, but then they expect Hillary to win and be the next president. But as
you said, the thing about Trump is either he wins the Republican nomination, in which case everyone will just side with whoever the Democrats put up, or he'll run as an independent, therefore cutting the Republican vote in half.
So he said that he's going to do that if he's quote unquote not treated fairly, which is wonderfully vague. It's like, okay, so how are you going to define that, Donald?
Where did he learn this?
apparently, years of scripting of The Apprentice in the USA.
Wow.
I wanted to talk briefly also about the fact that we have a petition submitted to Parliament, which now has over 450,000 signatures to ban Donald Trump from the UK. So this is obviously partially tongue in cheek, and
the person who put the poll together.
No, but I think
it wasn't tongue in cheek for her.
I feel like most people feel like this is obviously never going to happen.
Obviously,
but there are legitimate reasons.
George Osborne has already said that it won't happen at PMQs last week.
But I think it's a reasonable thing to kind of hold him up as somebody who is inciting hate speech, and we've banned people from the UK for that kind of stuff.
Well, they want to do the same to Katie Hopkins, don't they?
it's difficult when she is
a resident. Yeah, unfortunately.
If he came over here, he'd probably get less media coverage than if he was in the US.
We could do a swap, couldn't we? Really, they should be inviting Katie Hopkins over there, and we'll have Donald Trump, and everything will be great.
Yeah, no.
So we won't tolerate him, so they won't tolerate her.
So something that was something that
she'd run for.
Something that was hilarious when this petition came to light and was getting an awful lot of media attention, both over here and in the USA, Donald Trump then tweeted, and this convinces me that Trump is a troll. He tweets, "It's really good to see that there is a renowned Daily Mail columnist speaking the truth and then tagging Katie Hopkins. Katie Hopkins. And I was just
and
like...
she was like sending him love on Twitter.
And I was like, God, you're not real. Like, I swear...
Trump, yes or no?
He's not a troll. He's the genuine article. He actually believes what he says he believes.
There's genuinely some people who think that Donald Trump is like a sleeper cell in the Republican Party just so that Hillary Clinton wins. So he's meant to make them so unelectable. Yeah.
Phenomenal tactics.
Like really convoluted.
And they do deserve to win.
I think that just cements the fact that
top recruitment.
Any other top lines that you think we've missed with Mr. Trump? Apart from the fact that his name in the UK means fart.
I mean, we've already covered that in previous
podcasts. I know, but so, I feel like it needs to be reiterated as much as possible.
Yes. I feel we've given Trump already too much time on this podcast.
Amen.
He's kind of like as much as we've talked about Jeremy Corbyn and Labour, to be completely honest.
Yeah.
We're like broken records, but I love it every time that we talk about both of those
the
topics.
Ratio.
It's great.
I think we can leave it there.
Cool.
Hi, everybody. We're back. Is that what I'm supposed to say? I don't know how to... podcast.
So for them, we've been away for about 5 seconds.
Oh, God, you missed us. Okay. I missed you too. So in this next segment, we're going to be talking about BBC Culture have done a survey of lots of international critics and people and gathered together what the rest of the world thinks the top 100 British books are ever. And it turns out women are coming on quite okay in this poll. So we've got 6 out of the 10 books are written by women.
Out of the top ten.
Two men in the top ten. That's because Charles Dickens has overperformed, as usual, and has several novels in the top ten. But it's to underline there are only two men in the top ten. So what I wanted to discuss, on top of the Bailey's Prize, is celebrating its 20th year in circulation, which used to be the Orange Prize, and it's the Women's Prize for Fiction. And it was started because women were very underrepresented in other bookish prizes. Bookish sounds really patronising, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Bookish prizes. So I basically wanted to discuss, basically because as it's basically based on emotion, because I'm a woman, so that's what I do. Emotionally, I feel.
I think for the first time, there's been a statement about women on the podcast that we can't get slated
for. Don't worry, I'll do the woman bashing for you. I'm here. So as a woman, and just talking for me, as a knee-jerk reaction, if I wrote a book and the prize that I got was the Women's Prize for Fiction, I would slightly feel as you do when you're on the yellow table in maths at school, and everyone's like, "You're the best on the yellow table."
What's the yellow table?
You know when you're in groups at school and it's like the red table, the blue table, the orange table, and everybody knows that there's a smart table. Like blue means smart,
yeah.
Green means all right.
We didn't have
like,
system
do you know
in
what
my
mean?
School.
And like yellow means you're stupid, and, you know, and everybody knows what it means, but you're calling it different things, and it's like you're the best of the yellow table. You're the best of the women.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, I feel like I'm growing up in a very different literary and, like, gender climate than the people who started the Bailey's Prize or the Orange Prize. And there is a lot of rhetoric, I feel, especially in recent years, where they've been saying stuff like, this writer was fearless. We're here to talk about fearless women. And I'm like, that's brilliant. Now you've made me think that there might be something to fear. And I think that it's almost reversing. So, as well, my point is that the Man Booker Prize this year... Hanya, who wrote A Little Life, was one of the top, the six in the shortlist. There was two women and four men. And she was asked, basically, there was a lot of criticism of the top six, even though there were women in it, because there were no woman voices. There was no lead character in any of the books that were women. So she was asked, you know, why have, you know, you're a woman in the top six, why haven't you, you've written all about men? Because she writes about four men in New York who were all friends. And she was like, to be honest, I went to an all-girls school. We used to work in publishing, and I was kind of quite sick of talking about women. Yeah. Something that is unfamiliar to me is men. I wanted to write about men because I find them interesting and I find them, like, harder to understand.
So it's interesting because we've got, a large number of women at the top of publishing novels. And I should say, full disclosure... because I kind of shaded on Lena for not knowing who Angela Merkel was. We've just looked through the top 100, and I've read, like, three of the top 100.
To the Lighthouse, never heard of it.
I don't know why that's a thing. Like, I haven't heard of it.
This is my point, though. We're all under rocks.
Yeah,
we're all under rocks.
And thank you for giving me that perspective.
That's fine.
But do we have kind of... So this list kind of implies that some of our best... novelists are women. In terms of volume, though, how many... What's the kind of, like... And I'm hoping you know this because you work in publishing. What's kind of, like, the split between men and women in terms of those who go into novel writing?
I'd say it's, it depends on the genre you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So sci-fi is very, very male-heavy.
Yeah.
And especially leads a lot of women to publishing under aliases because life. Yeah. And non-fiction's quite male-heavy, depending on the subject matter. So lifestyle is very female-heavy and science mm-hmm. is very male-heavy. It's all very predictable and it's kind of what you can imagine. In fiction, it's very hard to say. I wouldn't want to, like, put a number on it, but I'd say that women are doing, like, pretty well now compared. I think we're doing all right. But there is also this problem, shelving problem, of women's fiction. And another problem I find with the Women's Prize is they don't include...
Is just, like, chick lit?
It's basically where Jane Austen would sit, like, 100 years ago.
Oh, right, okay.
You know, people would still perceive, like, 100 years ago, people would still look back on Austen and be like, oh, well, she's still women's fiction.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now we consider her... Now she's right up there with everybody else. But if you talk about romance and everything ends well, then you bet that you're in the women's fiction section and you won't be shortlisted for the Bailey's Women's Prize.
Would it be okay
What's
to have,
the
would,
logic?
Would it be okay to have women's fiction if there was a man's fiction section?
Well, exactly, if this is the problem. So, what do you think? Because I think no, but then I also think... At what point do we say, OK, we don't need... You know, things are there to move us on. At what point do we say, OK...
I feel like, generally, there's probably... I mean, women buy more books than men, like, full stop. But there's probably certain genres that men buy more of than women buy more of, right? So just recognising that men and women write different types of book... is a trend and read different types
but
of
then
book.
That, happens,
that seems okay.
That happens
right?
by genre, right? So isn't going to be more kind of accurate to have... books more defined by genre than by the gender of the person who's meant to be reading them.
Absolutely.
I find that really curious.
I find it hard to think that if I ever write a book it'll be seen as a book by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know that it's there. It was there to, like, to balance out a discrepancy in the mainstream prizes and the mainstream, like, reading patterns. But have we got there yet? Because I think a lot of the best-selling novels, which aren't the best ones for prizes... are women's books. And however much you say about Zoella, she sold a lot of copies,
didn't she?
It does sound that BBC article, though, that this is the foreign kind of perspective.
Yeah.
But when you go to the domestic perspective, it's quite different, isn't it, in terms of the number of women at the top.
There are more men than... And also a good point in one of the articles, I think it was in the FT I was reading, was that people were like, do people from other countries view what a British book is as slightly more women-centric and a little bit more twee and a little bit more... You know, do people look at Virginia Woolf and go, oh, she's so British. Look at all the funny phrases she uses in Mrs. Dalloway. She's so British.
So working in an American company, they're bloody obsessed with stuff like Downton Abbey. And I feel like Downton Abbey, correct me if I'm wrong, because I've already admitted I've read none of these books, but Downton Abbey kind of gives the impression of a kind of Jane Austen novel.
Yeah, it's like an upstairs, downstairs kind of. Yeah.
But so do you think, Elena, that we still need... a women's prize. Why did the women's prize exist in the first place?
Basically, I think the point, it should be working itself out of a job. I'm not saying that it doesn't have a job to do,
that's
but
kind
at
of like
some point it should
The argument
end.
For some feminists,
yeah, isn't
right?
That, isn't that the hope for everybody that we don't need them at some point? Because, if you know, they're there because of something that went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So for them to exist forever means that we're not doing our jobs, you know? I'm not saying it's over. I don't know. But I would say that there is a problem with a lot of, you know, a lot of people request, oh, like, can you review Amy Poehler's book? Can you review Tina Fey's book? Can you review Caitlin Moran's book? Can you review Lena Dunham's book? And I'm like, literally, these people have nothing in common. The only thing they have in common is that they're a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't put their books against each other because there's literally nothing about them that ties them together.
So that's interesting because... So all of those books that you mentioned, they all seem like they're at least marketed in a similar way in terms of, like, a woman's take
Big,
on the world.
Big, strong woman,
fearless. But is there a problem with that? Because I feel like there's been a lack of that in a lot of books that are published and in media in general.
I mean,
like,
actually, every time we discuss a film, Jazza is always complaining that there aren't enough.
That's kind of become my thing.
There's a film with Hugh Grant in called The Rewrite, and it's about a failing screenwriter who goes to teach at a university, and he's trying to pitch screenplays to this film company, and they keep coming back being like, you need a really strong female protagonist, otherwise we're not going to make this film. And he was just like, but that's not the only thing, you know? And I think there is a problem with the word strong when you call somebody a strong woman. If you call somebody a strong man, you're talking about a freak. You know, you're talking about somebody who's like either like insanely strong or somebody who's like physically a circus performer.
Yeah.
When you talk about a strong woman, you're somebody who's like, oh, well done you. You're so strong. You know?
Yeah. There's
and well done you. You wrote a book. And it's like, yes, I did. And I would like to be the man booker, not in the Bailey's. You know? I definitely think prizes in general do a really good job of drawing attention to books that might not have got that attention. Mm. But there's lots of different diverse issues we have with the book industry. And it's not always gender.
Yeah.
It's definitely a lot, like, what appalls me more is ethnicity and how little we have
I'm assuming class as well.
Class
we
have a class awards?
Yeah.
But how do you even...
How do you define that?
There's no way of even opening that so my, in a box. But you know
My boyfriend is a person of colour, and he came with me to an event that we both went to that was hosted by a UK publisher. Mm-hmm. And they did a series of interviews with a load of published authors from the past year.
Yeah.
And my boyfriend was like, they're all white.
Yeah, they were.
Like, they were all white and middle-aged and
was this a British thing?
It was one of the biggest publishers in the UK.
Well, Britain is still, like, 85, 88.
No, it is, but there was a selection of, like, 10 authors and not a single person was from a different background. I think that is representative of the industry as a whole, correct me if I'm wrong.
In general, like... Most industries are not proportional, and that's not because there's necessarily racism, although it can be because there's racism, but it's because different ethnic groups tend to go into different industries.
Yeah, but you don't know. You think... So there is this great British institution of the novel, and if there's... everybody seems to go to Zadie Smith as, like, the black experienced British author, and I can't really think of anybody else who has that kind of exposure and influence as her. And obviously it's great that she has it, but it's a shame that whole kind of genre and that kind of way of expressing yourself is closed off to people of a certain background, because it also means that there are fewer people who are from black and minority ethnic backgrounds who see that as like a thing that they could possibly write. I too could be a writer. And Zadie Smith talks about that.
You probably don't
bemoan
the fact that like middle and upper class people can't really do rap. Like you probably don't give a shit that that's not really a thing, do you?
I think that those are very different things.
It's the same thing, because you're saying that certain art forms are closed off to different social, ethnic, gender, whatever. That's just a fact, you know, of all art. And it doesn't just apply to people at the bottom of the food chain.
No, but
it also applies to people at the top of the food chain.
But I see a lot of white people who do go into rap, and middle-class people who do go into rap.
Me and you could not plausibly have a rap career.
No, but that's because we're bad. So, yes, there is kind of, like, the stereotype of a middle-class white person.
It's not a stereotype, mate. It's how genres work.
No, listen to me. There's a stereotype of a middle-class white person not being able to do a certain type of performance.
Yeah.
Such as rap, yes. But I think that there is more of a blockade of a kid from the East End of London who hasn't had the kind of education to be able to give them the tools to be able to go into plausibly the industry of writing books. Whereas I think that if somebody wanted to try hard enough, they can at least get the experience to be able to produce and to perhaps like work in the behind the scenes in that kind of music. Whereas there isn't that kind of a foundation building for people who are from more ethnically diverse and poor communities.
If you're richer, in general, more jobs are open to you. That will always be true. There's absolutely no way we can undercut that, ultimately.
But go on.
I also think we should underline the fact that there are quite a lot of white rappers and there are lots of problems with that because they have more attention than... It's a white supremacy issue with the audience where they, like, with Macklemore, it's like... Once Macklemore does it, everyone's like, yeah, innovative. Yeah. And they're like, hang on. It was same with the Azalea Banks.
Macklemore talks about... because he's not... I wouldn't define him as, like, middle class. But he's, like, hyper-aware of the fact that why do I have a load of, like, white teenagers at my concerts when the kind of music I make is very similar to this black rapper, this black rapper, this black rapper. But then you get... he's like, these kids have been allowed to like my music because their parents see me as non-threatening because I am a white face. Rather than a scary black man talking about blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And that is a very real thing that closes off.
Is it though? Jay-Z is infamous for being liked by white middle class kids.
Yeah, no, that's very true, but then he's not representative of the genre.
Also, this goes completely off topic because we're talking about rap, which is one genre of music, whereas we're talking about literature as a whole thing.
Like
men don't have access to women's fiction, do you know what I mean? It's a different... Well, like, most meditation books are written by women. Problem? Don't know. Not really that bothered. But that's more of a genre
It's the thing, fact you're not bothered, though, like a sort of flaw in your argument, though.
Definitely.
Okay.
I can only deal with so many flaws at a time, you know.
I think it does all come back to how we treat the audience as much as we treat the person who represents them as well, though. So, like, with Donald Trump, what we're really talking about is who follows Donald Trump and who thinks it's cool. And the same with the rap thing. And also the same with this Bailey's Prize issue, where actually I think women are very well represented in literary prizes now. But with literary critics, 82%... Like 80% of the London Review of Books is written by men. Mm. And most literary critics are men. That's the issue. It's the people looking at and commenting on the people.
I'm just wondering...
The same with the Macklemore audiences.
I'm wondering at what point you look at a situation like that and say... Obviously, there are issues of sexism and, discrimination, but there's a certain point where you'd have to look at, say, certain industries or whatever and say... This isn't about discrimination anymore. This is just about different demographics have a different tendency towards doing things. Like, I mean, the thing you
see... tendency is born. Like, do you think that's a good thing, that there is a tendency for people who are born in certain backgrounds to do certain things? Don't you think
it's inevitable, really?
It's defeatist.
Yeah, but it might be defeatist, but the question is whether or not it's true.
I'm not going to stay in the book industry if it stays this white for the next 10 years. I'll be so bored. You know, I'll be so bored.
You don't think white people will be able to write enough in...
No, Jimmy, that isn't the point, and you know it.
That sounds exactly like what the point is.
No, that's not the point at all. So quite rightly, white people can write about the experiences of black people. That is not something that we're saying isn't possible.
Yeah.
But also, you're inevitably going to be missing out on really authentic stories and really authentic experiences that is only going to be... identified by somebody from that background, and that is also inevitable.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a finite amount of time in life anyway, so you're going to miss out on some stuff, whatever happens.
No, but that's how misrepresentation happens, and that's how we stagnate as an industry, and then that's how everything goes down the shitter, basically.
We need to wrap this up because this is getting very...
Wrap it up. Right, let's do a wrap. Oh, no, wait, we're all white. Not do it.
Worse off having a dance competition.
Thank you very much for coming, Lena. Where can people find you on the internet if they want to hear more of your beautiful lulcet tones?
Lulcet
tones.
Lulcet. makes it sound a little bit more sensual, that I'm sure it is. You can find me at Lena Norms, LENANORMS. And then you can find a link to my YouTube channel from there. Just kiss my frog.
You can wade into this terrible debate that we've ended up descending into by tweeting at us at Right Dishonour, and also leaving comments on our website, which is rightdishonourable.com. We love it when that happens. It gets us very excited.
Great, like it.
Also,
Shazza often doesn't read them. So.
I read them. I only read them when you leave.
He's going
to
cut that out.
No, I'm not at all.
This man does any editing before he pushes this out.
I do some... I need to do some editing.
You need to edit them. Yeah.
But you can... what was I going to say? See, I'll have to edit this now.
You've said everything. You can comment and tell us what you think.
Oh,
I'm totally up to being persuaded out of everything I've said in this podcast, by the way. I believe it in this moment, but tomorrow, who knows? Please persuade me out of it.
Persuade us out of all of the arguments that we've made.
Yeah.
And call us out on where you think that we have gone wrong. I've been Jazza.
I've been Jimmy.
I will continue to be Lena.
Good for you.
I don't know who's dying.
And this has been The Right Dishonourable. Goodbye.
You have to stay here so you can... It will increase your concentration.
Yeah, I'll talk too fast if I need a wee.
I'm definitely keeping that in the end of the podcast.
Please put it in.